On Tech News Today, eBay and PayPal split into two companies, but they'll remain partners, as Gwyneth Paltrow would say, it's a conscious uncoupling. Plus, Intel's Basis company unveils a new smartwatch that quantifies yourself 24/7. And the Chinese government will finally let the iPhone 6 in through the front door after making sure it doesn't have any security backdoors. All that and more coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, September 30th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Braintree. If you're a developer or manager of a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the new OneTouch product by Braintree, the fastest, easiest, and most secure way to pay in-app. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/twit. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at Gazelle.com. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news of the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin, and I'd also like to have Jason welcome you all. Jason, will you welcome our viewers?
Welcome, viewers.
Thank you, Jason. That was really well done.
No problem.
Really well done. And we also have Joe Panettiere, who is coming to us live from Florida. How you doing, man?
Yes. I'm somewhere outside Orlando today, making my usual business rounds. I'm doing great, Mike. How you been?
Great. I've been great. Outside Orlando, isn't that like a swamp?
Yeah. You go a little bit to the east and you're in the water, and a little bit to the west and you're in the water. I'm actually a little bit north, so I think I'm okay.
Oh, okay. All right. You're in the dry part of just outside of Orlando. Well,
yeah,
Joe,
I'm in the Highlands, yeah.
That's right. Well, as we speak, Microsoft is announcing the next version of Windows and some other goodies, presumably for developers, enterprises, and power users. What do you think about this announcement? First of all, before we get into the details of this, do you think they're going to call it Windows 9, or are they just going to call it Windows, or is they going to call it, as people on Twitter are saying, Windows OS 10?
Well, I don't think it matters what they call it. As long as it's not Windows 8, I think they're in good shape.
Or Vista. Yes.
Vista.
So, I mean, we're here. What they're saying basically is they said, quote, hear what's next for Windows and the enterprise, unquote. That was the invitation, right? The cryptic invitation they sent out. We're expecting the return of the smart menu, a new virtual desktop feature, number of new changes to the traditional desktop area of Windows. And it's, you know, we're expecting a Windows technical preview coming out pretty soon. So, you know, Microsoft is every other version is good and every other version is not so good. This is supposed to be a good version. Do you think they'll be able to pull it off?
You know, I don't know. It's a little bit back to the future, isn't it, Mike, where Microsoft's actually hosting a quote-unquote enterprise-focused event. And it seems to me that in the 1990s with Microsoft, a lot of corporate adoption drove consumer adoption. If you got a great PC at work, you know, a Windows 3X or a Windows 95 machine, you brought that type of technology home and started to invest that way. I don't think we can ever go fully back to the future with that type of approach. But if Microsoft can at least stabilize its enterprise footprint, it might get enough adopters of this new operating system in the corporate setting where those people say, you know what, I'd really like to use this at home as well, and then drive adoption that way.
And you've got a wish list for the...
I certainly do. You know, I think you can really overthink this if you're a software company, as well as if you're a corporate CIO, because the event today is built for enterprise types. I hope Microsoft gets back to basics. And the thing I was thinking of this morning was sort of the five S's of, I hope, what Microsoft will deliver today. And those S's are certainly the start menu and or something really simple, or simplicity is the second S. Speed. Make sure this thing boots up and shuts down and recovers really quickly. And, you know, Microsoft has made progress in recent years there, but they haven't gotten the credit. And they really, I think, need to promote the speed. Security, of course. The enterprise is going to be interested in that. And then some sort of subscription model that is aligned with Office 365 going forward. And it's funny, Mike, when I put out that list, the five S's, start, simplicity, speed, security, and subscription, a few readers replied to me out on the After Nines blog, and they said, hey, don't forget the sixth S, and that is stability. So we'll be looking for that as well.
That's right. Now that Ballmer isn't there, they can't. They don't have anybody to write the blue screen of death notification for that operating system. So tune in today at 1 p.m. Pacific for our special edition of Windows Weekly with Padre is going to be hosting also with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. They're coming directly from the event, which is in San Francisco. So they're going to go to the event, and they're going to get in a fancy limo. They're going to come up here breaking all the speed laws. We're going to plunk them into chairs, and they're going to tell you everything you need to know about the event that is, again, happening right now. So, Joe, why don't we jump into the news and get started with our first story, which is eBay and PayPal will now become two separate companies next year. The current CEO, John Donahoe, will step down. eBay Marketplace's president, Devin Wenig, will become the CEO of eBay. American Express Enterprise Growth Group president, Dan Shulman, will become the CEO of PayPal. Roger Chang will remain the executive editor for CNET News, and he joins us now. Welcome to you, Roger Chang.
Thanks for having me.
Now, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion in 2002. It was a lot of money back then. Nowadays, that's not that much for an acquisition. But did this acquisition benefit either the company or their customers at any point?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, early on, obviously, there was the natural fit that eBay buyers and sellers could use PayPal. But it's always been sort of a tenuous relationship and not necessarily one that's logical beyond that sort of initial relationship. I don't think eBay's really been able to get as much out of the PayPal company and its assets as much as it would have liked. So I think it's a smart move that they're splitting. Obviously, this allows both companies to focus on the specific issues addressing both of them.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Roger, what about Carl Icahn's role here? He's an activist investor. He's been very active, to say the least, on this. He's been calling for a split. Is he essentially the winner here? Is eBay bowing to him?
I think so. I think it's just yet another instance where a company has bowed down to Carl Icahn's whim. And, you know, I think it was a smart push for Icahn, right? I think a lot of investors are asking for or questioning why eBay and PayPal should stick together. And the fact that eBay just a couple quarters ago was expressing the fact that eBay and PayPal should be together and then having this reversal today sort of, you know, illustrates that it was definitely a shareholder pressure that had a lot to do with this deal.
Now, the official justification had something to do with the how many of eBay's sales were processed through PayPal, a number right. or a percentage that is apparently dropping. Do you really buy that that explanation? And can you give us a sense of how much they're dropping?
Yeah, well, they say that less than a third of total transactions from PayPal are now processed through eBay or came from eBay, and eventually it'll get down about 15%. I don't think that's a real motivator. I think it's a great excuse for them to use. But the fact is these two businesses need to separate and focus on their own issues. Like I said, with eBay competing against Amazon and now PayPal competing against Apple Pay, now these are two companies with two different directions that should be split, really.
Hey, Roger, you bring up Apple Pay. Do you think PayPal as a separate company is in a better position to compete with Apple Pay potentially or a worse position? What are your thoughts so far?
I think strategically they're in a better position just in terms of having one company focused on mobile payments as opposed to a split organization. Having Dan Shulman coming in from American Express is a good move. He's a well-respected executive. He's been in both payments and mobile. He ran Virgin Mobile for a long time, did a really great job there. So he understands both industries very well. So I think strategically and from a management perspective, I think they're in a better position than they would have been if it was eBay and PayPal together.
Now, of course, Roger, you cover the industry broadly. There are acquisitions going on left and right all the time. It's really a pandemic of acquisitions these days. And I always think they've got to be really inefficient. You know, here's a perfect example of when they bought it. They spent a whole lot of money. They said it was a great idea. Now they're spinning it out back into a separate company. They're saying that's another great idea. I have the feeling that companies do this kind of thing because it's a power play. It makes it lines the pockets of the people who are involved in the acquisition. The lawyers all get rich. Everybody makes out like bandits, except for the customers and people who have to ultimately pay for the inefficiency of these acquisitions. That's my view. I'm not like a business expert, and I'm not really in that boardroom. What's your view as somebody who's probably covered probably thousands of acquisitions over the years?
It's very similar. Actually, I agree with you. There's in this situation, it's really the bankers and the lawyers who end up making a lot of money. And it is a case where a company needs to make a splash, and being able to split or acquire a company gives any company, you know, 12 months of room to operate, right? Investors typically give a company a pass when they're making a big move like this just to see how things shake out. And in this situation, eBay was having a tough time. The market environment was already looking a little bit tough for them. So by splitting up in these two different businesses, that each of them sort of give themselves a little bit of runway to operate without too much investor scrutiny.
Roger Cheng writes at CNET.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Roger W. Cheng. That's C-H-E-N-G. Thank you so much for joining us, Roger Cheng.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, we've got a new sponsor debuting today called Braintree. Braintree solves one of the biggest problems in online commerce, which is that people often start out intending to buy something, but for some reason end up abandoning their cart. And that's one of the ways Braintree can help. Braintree is the fastest, easiest, and most secure way to pay, and it lets your mobile app customers use any payment type they want, including credit and debit cards, PayPal, Venmo, Bitcoin, Apple Pay, and all in 130 currencies. PayPal's Braintree one-touch checkout is a simple and elegant solution for both you and your customers. Braintree's SDK is available in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. This is elegant code with clear documentation, only 10 lines of in-app code. If you're an app developer or manager, check out Braintree today at braintreepayments.com/twit. Review their documentation. It's simple and concise. Play around in their sandbox. Give Braintree a try with no commitment. Test your integration before going to production. Once you decide to implement OneTouch, your first $50,000 in transactions are fee-free. That's braintreepayments.com/twit. And Braintree is the payments API used by Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, GitHub, and many others. And if you've ever used any of these services, let Braintree know what you think of the experience by tweeting about it and mentioning the Twitter name at Braintree. We thank Braintree for their support of Tech News Today. Well, Joe, Intel's got, a company owned by Intel's got a new smartwatch, and it sounds pretty smart, actually.
Does sound smart. We'll see if they're going to deliver the goods here. Now, Intel's upping the smartwatch ante, so to speak, with a technology or a device called Basis Peak. Now, here with details is Owen Thomas, the editor-in-chief of ReadWrite. Hey, Owen, are you on the line with us?
I am. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Can you give us the big picture here? What exactly is Basis Peak?
So Basis Peak is the successor to Basis V1, which was the first fitness band from this company. Basis Peak is the first device that they've released since Intel bought them for a reported $100 million, $150 million back in March. So a lot on the line. It puts Intel, as I said, in the arm race. They're trying to get space on your wrist. What the Peak does, which really differentiates itself, which differentiates it from, say, a Jawbone Up or a Fitbit, is it tracks your heart rate, and it tracks your heart rate all day long. That's the key thing it does. And if you measure your heart rate, you get a better sense of how many calories you're really burning. It goes beyond just steps. And it also gives you an idea of your sleep quality, and that's important to a lot of people. And the price is going to be $199. It's going to be out in November, sold at Amazon, Best Buy, REI. And I think they're targeting probably targeting more athletic folks who exercise pretty seriously. It's more expensive than the Pebble, which starts at $99, but less expensive than the Apple Watch, which is going to be $349 when it comes out next year.
Now, my understanding with the B1 is that it just didn't track your heart rate when you were at rest. And essentially what they've done here to really improve it is they turn up the high beams. They've got much more powerful LEDs.
Exactly right. I was playing with it in Basis's office earlier this week, and that's really what they've done is they use optical heart rate. So they shine a light on your arm and they measure the pulsing of your blood. And that's kind of the trick of it. There are other folks who use optical heart rate. In fact, Samsung, Apple, most folks who are releasing a watch with heart rate features use this technology, but it's hard to perfect. It's hard to get just right. And I think with the B1, they really optimized it for long battery life. And as a result, you know, when you were out for a run and you wanted to see, like, you know, if you spiked your heart rate, it didn't really capture that spike. So I think a lot of people who are kind of fitness oriented, who are more likely buyers of this kind of device, were disappointed with its performance. And now Basis CEO Jeff Holub tells me they've got it down. They can do exercise and they can do 24/7 tracking. And then it all syncs to your phone. You've got a companion app that tells you kind of where you are in your fitness progress.
Yeah, Owen, you bring up that companion app. Do you see a market developing here for third-party apps tied to Basis Peak? I mean, it looks like Apple's trying, for instance, to create an ecosystem with the Apple Health Kit. Do you see Basis trying to do something similar with Peak?
Right now, they seem pretty closed off, but I think that's just kind of their initial strategy. Mm-hmm. It's hard to build an ecosystem. If you look at Pebble, they've put a lot of work into it. Apple obviously has a long history with developers, so they've got an edge. But I think first they've got to get the device out there. They can't just say, hey, developers, do you want to build an app for us? They have to build their own app first and get some users, and then I think developers will be interested. The price point is a little tricky. It's kind of not the cheapest. It's not the most expensive. So we'll have to see how many users there are. And then we can talk about developers getting interested.
Owen, what's in it for Intel?
I think that, you know, Intel, I think, had sales of $54 billion last year. They're mostly a chip maker still. I think this lets them get into wearables, understand the market. I don't think they're really going to move the needle, whether they sell a lot of Basis Peaks or they don't sell any. It's not really going to hit the bottom line. But it does give them an idea of, what does it take to make a really great wearable? What are the components? How can Intel get inside your smartwatch?
Mm-hmm. You know, Owen, you just brought up a key point there in terms of Intel sort of using this as market R&D and really gathering intelligence. The question I would have is can Intel, leveraging Basis, really deliver a cool hip factor, you know, the type of thing that Apple always enjoys? You know, the fanboys just jump on board before they've even seen an Apple device or touched it. Does Basis have that type of hip factor at all with the early adopters?
I mean, it seems that they're very much leading with the Basis brand, not the Intel mm-hmm. brand. I don't think right. you really rush out and buy an Intel device these days. I don't think that was ever true, even in kind of the heyday of the Intel Inside campaign with PCs. You know, every desktop PC used to come with that sticker. And it was kind of an assurance that, okay, yes, this is a normal PC, but it didn't really tell you, is this a great PC? Is it a lousy PC? There was never like a really clear brand promise around Intel. So maybe they can make Basis a great brand in wearables kind of on its own. I don't think, though, that really shifts, you know, consumer awareness of Intel. People all kind of mm-hmm. have heard of Intel, but they don't know what Intel can do for them. Basis is going to give a much more specific promise that this device will help you improve your health and fitness. And I think they may need actually new brands like that, especially in wearables, which is kind of a wide open field, with more specific promises. And then they need to deliver on them.
Owen Thomas both reads and writes at readwrite.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Owen Thomas. Thanks so much for joining us today, Owen.
My pleasure. All
right. Well, after holding back the launch of the iPhone 6 in China on September 19th, the Chinese government finally approved the phone for sale 1 month after the U.S. launch. The new Chinese ship date is October 17th. The Chinese government said they needed extra time to look for security backdoors through which the U.S. government might spy on Chinese users. Joe Panettiere, I don't buy it. I think they're full of hooey. I think this is all a big political show to demonstrate that they're standing up to the United States and to American technology companies for the benefit mm-hmm. of Chinese technology companies and also the Chinese hardliners. What do you think?
You know, it's hard to argue with you, Mike. I think the examples keep coming at every angle, whether it's Apple or Microsoft, and the list goes on. It's the mobile device makers. It is the wireless companies, or even the car companies out of the U.S. Over and over again, China's taking a stand and raising this inhibitor to get into their market. And even if it's not a complete no, you can't come here, there always seems to be a delay or some sort of time out, hold on, this is going to take a little bit before you allow to come into our market.
Absolutely. And China, the Chinese government knows they have the most valuable thing in the world for international brands, which is the world's largest consumer market. And yes. just to give you an example, this is the first phone that's going to release on the three major Chinese carriers, which are China Mobile, China Unicom, and Hong Kong, and China Telecom. Together, these three carriers have, are you ready for this, more than 1.27 billion mobile subscribers. That is just enormous.
Yeah, as we might say in the movie world, that number is ginormous, without a doubt. I think the thing that further complicates this is even for us coming on the show and saying, well, China's full of hooey, the problem you really have going forward also is more and more of the U.S. companies running into trade issues and or business practice issues in Europe. And I would raise them as yellow flags rather than red flags. But those yellow flags in Europe almost gives credence to the red flags we're seeing in China. And I hope we can draw a line between the two, because the issues we see in Europe over and over again, very often there are some basis for concerns for those. Jumping back to China for a moment, Mike, what I'm curious about going forward is as Apple, as Google and others begin to introduce more and more mobile devices that are basically standardized on encryption, I wonder how the Chinese government's going to react to that long term.
They do definitely don't want Chinese citizens and Falun Gong practitioners and pro-democracy activists and anybody else within China able to communicate freely to each other without being under the gaze of the Chinese authorities. They do not want that. And yet, as you say, both Google and Apple have promised that not only will they not provide this kind of information to governments, they cannot provide. They've set it up so that they don't have access to the encryption keys. And I think that it's possible that China is working hard to figure out how to crack the encryption of all of these devices. It's theoretically crackable. There are many ways around these things, as any hacker can tell you. But it's again, it's something that they're not going to just accept. They're not going to just simply sit back and say, well, I guess we can't eavesdrop on anyone's conversations. They got that encryption. They got that Apple encryption. What are you going to do? They're not going to do that. I guarantee it. Now, one of the interesting factors about the iPhone 6 in China is the price. Everything is more expensive in China. We talked about the Xbox being launched in China at a $200 markup from the U.S. price. In China, the iPhone 6 is the same thing. The iPhone 6, the minimum bottom of the line iPhone 6 with the minimum storage is $860 unlocked. The iPhone 6 Plus with 128 gigs of storage will cost $1,266. Who's going to pay that in China? $1,300 for a phone. I mean, it's quite enormous.
Yeah, you know, we'll see if Apple puts out one of those infamous press releases saying, hey, we sold 10,000 or 10 million of the new iPhones over the weekend over in China. I doubt they will, but you never know. The other thing to watch here with those price points you mentioned, Mike, is Lenovo. And the reason I bring up Lenovo is here in the U.S., in the States, and also in Europe, Lenovo is perhaps best known for the ThinkPads that they acquired from IBM. Now they've bought IBM server business, but over in China and Asia and many other countries, Lenovo really is known as a fast growth smartphone producer. So I would watch those iPhone price deltas and price points and compare and contrast them to what we're seeing from Lenovo, and also sort of weave in that China government story, tie it all together, and you can begin to see where the balance of power may or may not shift over time in China.
Definitely. And of course, yesterday we reported on a story that emerged in the in China, in a newspaper in China, that said that the smugglers have already satisfied the demand for the most part for iPhones. I don't believe it. And I think what we're going to see in October is that when they do officially ship the iPhone, that there's going to be a huge amount of purchases there. I don't think the demand is satisfied at all. I think they're just barely getting started. Well, Joe, looks like Google is going to take another try at bat in the streaming music business.
Yeah, you know, and the complicated topic here involves the fact that Google's really going after the music service with two platforms. You've got the YouTube platform, where people are very familiar with, of course, millions and millions of subscribers and or community members. Community members probably being the better term there. Then you've got Google's All Access subscription service. Now, that's their streaming service, and we're seeing some enhancements coming on both fronts. Reuters is reporting that the YouTube service, within the next few weeks, is going to be able to let you really queue up multiple songs all at once, so that you're not just picking one song and then waiting for that to end and then picking the next. It really becomes a long-term jukebox approach, it almost sounds like to me. But at the same time, they're continuing to make enhancements to All Access, Mike. And you wonder, is Google basically putting its bets in too many areas here? And shouldn't they be putting all their weight or all their wood behind one arrow? I don't have the answer yet, but I'm watching closely.
Well, it's not the Google way, unfortunately. I mean, sometimes I wish they would do that sort of thing so that they would say, as Apple does and some other companies do, here is the product. This is the best, very best product for everybody, and here it is. And those of us who want to be subscribers or whatever, we can just go sign up and we can get Google's best product. But, of course, you know, they're scattered all over the place. And YouTube is a little bit of a weird kind of accidental success story. I'm not sure they're doing all they can to monetize it right now, but YouTube is gigantic for streaming music and, of course, videos and everything else. Just to put in perspective the difference in size between these music services, All Access is in the sort of 500,000 users range. They're in there with a few others such as Rhapsody and Deezer. But you look at Spotify, they have more than 10 million paying subscribers. So that's really the target that Google wants to go after. And, you know, they're going to have to work really hard to get there because people don't think about Google when they think about streaming music.
Yeah. And the other thing with Google very often is people don't think about paid services. When people think about Google, they think about free search or advertised supported search. They think about Google Apps and very often a free approach to Google Apps rather than a corporate approach. So it's free, free, free all the time at Google. And now they're trying to build these paid subscription services with All Access being a prime example. So, you know, you already mentioned the limited adoption there. On the flip side, you look at YouTube and the millions of adopters there, but yet it's free and ad-driven. The thing to watch with YouTube is there are some clues coming out from Wall Street. If you read some of the recent blogs coming out of Wall Street financial analysts, they're all warning that Google's profits could be squeezed a little bit by all the quote-unquote content investments in YouTube. To me, that's some sort of tip-off that something huge is coming with YouTube. I wonder if it's part of the music strategy.
Yeah, it's probably part of a music strategy, a TV strategy, a movie strategy, a sort of YouTube personality strategy. They, you know, this is how Google thinks about the world. They don't have a huge amount of confidence in their own belief about what's going to happen. And so they hedge all their bets and they want to cover all that ground. And, you know, in the area of online streaming content, whether it's video, audio, or whatever, that's a good strategy because it's really difficult to understand where things are going. I mean, who could have bet? You know, we've all seen these statistics recently that for people under the age of 20 or so, the people who are big stars on YouTube are bigger stars than movie stars and TV stars and music stars. The biggest, very biggest stars for young people are the Pootie Pies of the world, the YouTube personalities. And so, you know, so who could have predicted that? I don't think anybody predicted that. And still, the media, you know, Hollywood's having a hard time digesting that little sour bit of information. So, you know, it is probably a good strategy to throw it all against the wall. But if they want to get serious about streaming music, they can. They're going to have to work harder to go after Spotify. Well, in just a sec, we have some follow-ups for you. But first, I want to tell you about Gazelle. You got an old iPhone sitting around? Why? If you do, it's probably because you think that it's kind of a hassle to do something about that phone to get some money for it. You know it's worth money, but you think it's a hassle. Well, I'm here to tell you that it isn't a hassle. It's super, super easy, and it is free to do. Just go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. Find the iPhone that you've got, the iPad, whatever it is. Identify it, indicate its condition, and then they'll give you a price. It really takes seconds to get to this point in the process, and then once you see that price, it'll be, you know, and most likely it'll be in the hundreds of dollars, which will help fund your next purchase. And then they send you a box. You put it in the box, you put the sticker on the box, and off it goes. That's all there is to it. And then you get paid. You get paid by check. You get paid by PayPal. You get paid an extra 5% if you choose the Amazon gift card option, which is the one that I always choose because I like that extra 5%. Free money is good. Gazelle's paid more than nearly $175 million to over 1 million customers. Again, shipping is free, processing is fast. There's no reason not to use Gazelle. Find out what your iPhone's worth. Take a minute. Go to gazelle.com and find out. Well, as Google announced and we reported back in June, today is the last day of Google's first social network, Orkut. And that means it's the last day to export your data. The service was so dominated by users in Brazil for some reason, so much so that the default language for the shutdown notice is Portuguese, with a secondary option to see it in English for the tiny minority of users who speak English. Did you ever use Orkut, Joe Panettiere?
I did not, and I'm curious. I have not read the Portuguese warning about this shutdown or information about the shutdown, but are they trying to move people over to Google Plus with this? And if so, is that a sure that I'll be sticking around for Google Plus for a while? Because I am a Google Plus fan.
Yeah, it assures that you're going to have a lot more Portuguese language people interacting with you on Google Plus. Fortunately, unlike Orkut, Google Plus has instant translation, so you can simply translate from Portuguese. But yeah, they're trying hard to move everybody over to Google Plus, and they've got an somewhat automated process for moving your data. And you know, it's a good thing. I mean, it's actually, to me, it's a miracle that Orkut has survived this long. It was a 20% project by some Google employee that turned into a very early social network. It's pretty old. It had a lot of users in India as well, so it gained some traction in some markets. But it really got ridiculous. The degree of Portuguese language dominance on that system, and in the absence of translation services, meant that for people who spoke other languages such as English, it was really kind of an alien landscape and very difficult to interact with strangers. Unlike Google Plus, where it's trivially easy to interact with people from all over the world who speak all kinds of different languages, because again of that a wonderful translation system that they have built into Google Plus. So farewell to Orkut. We hardly knew you. It was really mostly a Facebook clone. And not only was it a Facebook clone, it remained a throwback to a clone of an old version of Facebook. So it was kind of a relic even yesterday to look at it. So good riddance to Orkut and hello Google Plus. You know, people think that Google Plus is shrinking and so on. And I can assure you that it is not. The number of new users is pretty much stable, and they tend to be very international. And this is a deliberate plan on the part of Google. They really want the whole world to be on a single social network, just like Facebook. So we'll see where it goes. And again, farewell to Orkut. It's a new chapter in Google social networking. Well, in other news, we reported on Thursday that the newly resurfaced Shellshock bug affects OS X systems in addition to Unix and Linux systems. Apple released fixes today, which are separate downloads for the Mavericks, Mountain Lion, and Lion versions of OS X. And even for most users, this was not a real issue. You had to have a very specific set of circumstances to be affected by this. It was all pretty theoretical, I think, for most people. Joe, we never got a chance to talk about the Shellshock bug. This is quite an event, isn't it? I mean, it's really rare to see the real security experts truly flipping out.
Yeah, it really is. And you know when I knew it was a serious issue is a friend of mine from my Ziff Davis days and my ZDNet days, Stephen J. Von Nichols, was reporting about it. And Stephen tends to be proactive when it comes to open source. He tends to be an upbeat guy when it comes to Linux. And when he was raising the issues on his blog, I knew, okay, let me do a timeout here and really read up on this and make sure I have a full understanding as to whether or not I'm at risk. So, some Mac users were at risk, but as I understand it, you had to be more of an administrator who was mucking around with the code to really expose yourself to the problem. So I think, generally speaking, the day-to-day Mac user is okay here, but boy, out in the Linux and Unix world, the alarms were going off and going off like wild.
Yeah, as well they should. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Andrew Ibanez in Lleida, Spain, who says he watches TNT on his brand spanking new Android TV, and there it is. He's even got a little Android robot to prove it.
To drive that point home.
Yes, in case there was any question as to whether or not this was an Apple TV. How do you watch or listen to TNT? Just record a video or take a picture of your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, anywhere you like. Just use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it. Joe Panettiere and Jason Howell, that is the tech news today. So, Joe, what are you working on now that you have a new company and a new blog?
You know what? I keep feeding you guys really small bits and pieces of what we're up to. We haven't announced much with After Nines. We announced the company 2 weeks ago. Here's another just small tip for you guys. Not a huge thing, but we're launching a newsletter on October 6th, which is a week from yesterday. And we'll keep building it from there. We have a few other surprises in store. But, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself. We're building it out one stage at a time, and the next stage is just the newsletter starting on Monday.
Wonderful. Looking forward to reading it. And I thank you for joining us every Tuesday on Tech News Today as our co-anchor.
Thank you very much, Mike. And Jason, take care as well.
You bet. Thanks, sir.
You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, so many options. Choose your favorite at twit.tv/TNT. You can follow us on Twitter. Tech News Today TV is our Twitter name. And you can follow us on Ello at Tech News Today. Please send us your thoughts and opinions by sending email to tnt@twit.tv. You can call us, too, at 260-TNT-SHOW. That's our phone number. You can leave a voicemail. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific, every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. And don't miss our special edition of Windows Weekly today at 1 p.m., where we'll bring you up to date on all the news from today's Microsoft event. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.